Good morning and welcome to Shattering Myths. I am Yada. Each weekday here on GCN, we strive to expose the destructive myths which are associated with religion, all religions really, with political schemes, virtually all of them again, with patriotism and with the media, as well as with military and economic schemes. Instead of merely presenting the news, our mission on this program during the first hour is to understand what is actually occurring behind the headlines, and then to think about how these events will shape our world over the next 10 to 20 years. Then during our second hour, we're going to engage God on his terms through evidence and reason, since his is the lone reliable voice in an exceedingly troubled world. Our phone number for those who would like to participate in this discussion at any time over the next 2 hours is 877-300-7645. We read in the news today that gunmen, it doesn't say that they are members of Islamic terrorist groups, doesn't say that they are operating under the instructions of the Pakistani ISI, which is a division of the Pakistani military. It doesn't say that they are firing American-made weapons that were given to the Pakistanis to bribe them to be loyal to the United States. It just says that gunmen have killed at least 13 bus passengers in southwest Pakistan. Yes, what they did is these Islamic militants, these men who did not corrupt their religion, but had their religion corrupt them, deliberately blocked the road. And then as they forced the two buses to stop, they took the passengers away, shot each of the individuals at point-blank range, killing 13 and hauling their bodies to a nearby trench. My investigation of religion began similarly. Now, I wasn't on the bus, but when 9/11 occurred, and I was convinced, having come to know George W. Bush, that he was going to do all of the wrong things, that he had already told me prior to being elected president that he wanted a crisis because in a crisis he thought that he would become popular because of his particular skill set. He said that was the thing that he most wanted when elected president, was a crisis to show off his skill sets of leadership. And so I knew exactly what he was going to do. He had told me what he was going to do privately before he was elected. He was going to declare war. And I knew that was going to be a tragic mistake, because when you have individuals who are obviously associated with a religion who kill people as indiscriminately as occurred with the Islamic suicide bombers of 9/11, when you fight them using conventional means, bullets and bombs, you actually expand their numbers, you embrazen them, you enrage more, you manufacture 100 for everyone you kill. I knew that was going to be counterproductive. Now, at that time, I didn't know enough about Islam to enter a debate with a 5-year-old child. And so what I did is I decided, you know, I need to find out whether or not Muslims have corrupted their religion or their religion has corrupted them. And the best way to do that is to go to talk to the terrorist directly. Now, the ground zero for Islamic terrorism was and still remains the Islamic-controlled areas of Jerusalem and Israel. And so there I asked Islamic terrorists why it was that they were killing. And they quoted the Quran and Hadith. They quoted so many passages from the Quran and Hadith, it became apparent that the American politicians and media and academicians were lying when they said that that these individuals were radicals, they were extremists, they had corrupted their religion, that Islam was peaceful. And, of course, then I spent 10,000 hours thereafter coming not only to understand the religion, but writing the most comprehensive presentation of Muhammad's words and deeds. But as it relates to this bus tragedy, that was my introduction to Islamic terrorism. The first three men that I met in Zone A of Israel, in a catacomb down beneath the ground, all with slits and bars over these slits of windows, one dangling light bulb in the middle of the room, and them armed to the teeth. These three men came in and in uniforms. Uniforms they had, they said, were purchased by the United States. They were carrying United States rifles given to them by the U.S. government. They spoke fluent English because they had been trained by the United States in the United States. And they promptly told me, said, did you, are you aware of the incident on the road to Emmanuel last night? And I said, yeah, I read it by all of the newspaper. Armed gunmen stopped a bus. They blew off the axle, stopped a bus, forced the women and children to leave the bus, and one by one, they blew off their heads at point-blank range. And these three men, smiling, said, that was us. We did that. And they did it, of course, with American weapons, firing American bullets, wearing American uniforms, having been trained by the United States. They were members of the Oscar Martyrs Brigade. The Oscar Martyrs Brigade was the militant wing of Fatah, which is part of the political arm of the PLO. And they said, but, you know, we're not terrorists because we did not commit a suicide bombing. We used our weapons. And so this specific tragedy that took place in Pakistan, well, one more individual was killed than was killed in on the roads to Emmanuel when I was there, but exactly the same strategy by individuals deploying American weapons. It has been now 12 years between those events. And while I have done my best, I have done some 3,000 talk radio programs to expose the horrid nature of the Islamic religion and how it corrupts individuals and how Islam not only is a terrorist manifesto, but a declaration of war on all humankind. And written two books on Islam, a third even the Islamic terrorist timeline. And now I've devoted myself to this show where the first half of the show focuses on religious and political corruption, military corruption. How much really is different? You know, sometimes you just read news items and say, it's been 12 years. You devoted your life, much of it to this. I mean, most of my life now is devoted to introducing people to Yahweh's testimony, to his covenant, to his means of salvation. But much of my life over the last 12 years has been devoted to this. And yet you read an article. This from the BBC, and you see, nothing has changed. The BBC is unable to identify the people who did this as fundamentalist Muslims. They won't do so. They won't say that they did so in Allah's cause. They won't say that they were screaming Allahu Akbar. They won't identify it with the actions of the mythical people known as the Palestinians, who America wants to reward with a state, who did the same thing 12 years ago. A related item in the news is that five Indian soldiers were murdered in the Indian-administered Jammu and Kashmir regions. This happened also today. India's army accused Pakistan over the incident, of course. It's the Pakistanis that are never satisfied with what they have stolen. They always crave more. These five Indian soldiers entered were marching through, walking through the Indian administered area, and they were ambushed, murdered. Of course, the Pakistani government, just as they do with every murder that they commit, every act of terrorism that they sponsor, they said, oh, no fire took place. So, no, I'm sure that the Indian troops shot one another. You know, when you have a religion that is based entirely on lies, a religion where it's where the chief prophet not only admitted lying, but authorized lying, a religion where the God of that religion acknowledges that he lies and makes up things and then changes his minds and even embraces lies, saying that your oath is not binding on you, you would expect them to lie. Over the last week, turning to another but related story, the United States says that it has intercepted conversations between two senior al-Qaeda figures that prompted the U.S. to shut down embassies in North Africa and across the Middle East. And you even have morons in the U.S. Congress that are saying, see, huh, proof that that our PRISM program and our wiretap program is delivering results. Well, first of all, the PRISM program and the wiretap programs were spying on Americans and American keystrokes. It not those in foreign lands. The NSA has always had the authorization and did not need a secret court to listen into and to spy on those that were posing threats abroad. No correlation whatsoever. The congressmen, many of them who made this statement, know that, so they were deliberately trying to deceive the American people. Beyond that, the statement of al-Zawahiri wasn't a statement that the United States intercepted. Broad statement, Zawahiri is about the only surviving member of al-Qaeda. And he, on occasion, about once every 3 or 4 months, just as did Osama bin Laden before we murdered him, releases a statement. He released a statement. You know, you don't need a spy network to intercept a public declaration. No, when somebody puts out a press release, you really do not need a spy apparatus to intercept it. It is also interesting that this communique was with the al-Qaeda branch in Yemen, because of the fact that when Osama bin Laden was alive, he specifically denounced any association with the Yemeni branch of al-Qaeda, saying that they were not doing his bidding. So why is Zawahiri suggesting perhaps maybe they should? Welcome back to Shattering Myths. It is interesting that that while Osama bin Laden was alive, the three organizations, terrorist clubs, Islamic jihadist organizations that are principally ascribed to be affiliates of al-Qaeda. That would be the Islamic movement in Iraq, which had no affiliation whatsoever, didn't even exist prior to the American invasion, had no affiliation whatsoever with Osama bin Laden and al-Qaeda, but the Islamic movement in Iraq. The al-Qaeda of the Arabian Peninsula, which was founded by an American Muslim, and its sole purpose is for disseminating propaganda regarding Islam on the Internet. I mean, that's apart from disseminating information publicly through Inspire magazine and through just public disclosure on the Internet, it had no other purpose. That didn't exist except as a website. And the third is that one of several score of Islamic terrorist organizations that have emerged from the mistake of supporting the rebels in Libya is occasionally is called the base or al-Qaeda of the Maghreb, this area of the Sahara area. And so there are three. And during Osama bin Laden's last 7 or 8 years, he sent handwritten communiques. He recognized that anything that he wrote online, anything that he said on a cell phone or a satellite phone would be intercepted by the United States. The Islamic terrorists knew this decades before Snowden released it. And that's why anything that Ayman al-Zawahiri says that he communicates by phone or by recorded message or by electronic device or online is for public dissemination. It's a press release. He's not secretly communicating a message using any of those devices. They use handwritten notes and carriers because of the NSA's capability. And they've done that now for a decade or more. So it is interesting now that even though Osama bin Laden's, all of his internal messages, the copies that he kept of his communications with those individuals, they never communicated with him. And his communications to them were always derogatory. You should not be using the name that's been ascribed to me, the Al-Qaeda base name. You don't represent Islam effectively. And he denounced them and denounced any association with them. Now, it is very possible, and I would say likely, that since Ayman al-Zawahiri is not a charismatic individual. He's reasonably smart for a Muslim, not saying much, but he's certainly not the kind of person that is going to be able to garner individual devotion. So when Osama bin Laden, who had a charismatic personality, ultimately was destined to live out the last 8 to 10 years of his life in hiding. All he did is denounce Islamic organizations around the world, particularly those that bore some aspect of his name. But Zawahiri, now that there really is no al-Qaeda, at least the original al-Qaeda is kaput, doesn't exist anymore, he could very well have no other option to, if he wants to remain even quasi-relevant, to be trying to reach out and communicate and associate with organizations like the Islamic movement in Iraq and like the website Al-Qaeda of the Arabian Peninsula. So that would be the only way that he can maintain relevance. And once these guys get some international acclaim, that's what they crave. They love the attention that's associated with it. Therefore, it is interesting that maybe the United States' own actions associating all of these things with Al-Qaeda and making Al-Qaeda the enemy as opposed to Islam actually became a self-fulfilling prophecy. But regardless, this idea that that we have shut down all of our embassies and we've told Americans not to travel is really nothing more than these Muslims recognizing they could play Americans for fools, that it was easy to toy with Americans. You could get Americans now to cower just by going boo. And look at us. We shut down our embassies. We put fences around our properties. We told our people not to travel. Why? Because the Muslims said, boo. We're being played for fools. They're laughing at us. And considering how dumb they are, doesn't say much about us, does it? We'll return to Shattering Myths in a moment. Welcome back to Shattering Myths. It is also a shame and that the United States doesn't seem to be able to make the connection. But yesterday, the United States fired lethal drone strikes on a car in central Yemen. Of course, the United States won't comment on its use of drones. But when we murder the individuals and families that we think are directly associated with the promotion of the Islamic religion, what we end up doing is enraging Muslims all the more. To a large degree, the reason that Jokhar and Tamerlane Sarnarov decided that the appropriate thing to do according to Islam and Allah was to maim and murder innocent Americans is because Americans we're killing Muslims. So when America fires its drones and kills Muslims in Yemen, America is actually responsible for inciting the rage that inspires so many Islamic terrorist attacks. But we do something else, and this is a point I know that I've had a difficult time communicating, and I bear the responsibility for being unable to articulate it in a way that resonates. But when we use weapons of war in other countries to seek out and to kill those that we deem to be at war with us, we legitimize their cause. We make them soldiers. We announce that a war is taking place. And therefore, it is impossible morally for us to be right in being able to attack them and kill them in other countries without due process, without the rule of law, and then say that when they do the same in our country, like the Shinarev brothers, that they are terrorists and not soldiers. If we are soldiers and doing what is moral by killing them, then when they respond and kill us, so are they. Now, the fact is, neither of us are operating on a moral basis. Neither of us are justified. But the moment you begin to call this religious decree a war on terrorism, and you go off and you use weapons of war in other countries without due process to kill those advocating that war, then it becomes morally inappropriate when the Mujahideen fighting on the other side kill, and you say that they are terrorists and not soldiers engaged in an act of war. We have Glenn on the line, and I think Glenn wants to make a comment about how things really haven't changed very much over the last dozen years. Hi, Glenn.
Well, yes, the point you just made segues very nicely into my point, and it ties into what you said originally. I'm fixing my headset here. I'm going to switch.
That should sound better.
That is, a little less echo.
Okay, very good. Okay, I mean, first of all, please tell me you're not surprised at this. Certainly you know that as in the days of Noah, so shall the coming of the Son of Man be. You have a specific time frame for which you expect certain events to happen. Certainly you must at least intellectually realize that, things are going to get worse rather than better in these regards. And
Well, that's for me to comment on that. You're right. That is absolutely true. I am not surprised. And that does not mean, though, that it would be inappropriate to be disappointed. When you make this large an effort to try to expose and condemn the source of Islamic terrorism over a course of 12 years, and you realize that over that 12 years you haven't made much of a difference, and that people continue to die and will continue to die without ever waking up to the truth, without ever responding in a moral and rational way, it is disappointing. So, surprise, no.
Well, it's
disappointing. Yeah, of course, and that's exactly what I'm thinking. If I'm disappointed and I'm just, a little nobody here, it's got to be absolutely distraught over this. When Yahweh returns and all of those who have not embraced the covenant, which will be the overwhelming preponderance of those who survive up to the point of those, the culmination of the world wars. The idea that at one instant a billion or more people are going to be vaporized is not going to bother him in the least. You can get to a point where you realize people are so corrupt, they're so perverted, they're so deadly, that eliminating them is actually the most merciful and loving and kind thing you could possibly do. And I think Yah's got to be very close to that point.
Well, we know, God takes no pleasure in the death of the wicked. He's not willing that any should perish, et cetera, et cetera. But, it's a matter of brutal necessity. So
And Glenn, there's a difference between taking pleasure in and the realization that when he returns, 1 billion people are instantly going to be vaporized, and having no remorse. I mean, having not even a second thought of saying, "Boy, you know, that was pretty harsh." No, it's that we there's so many. And such a preponderance of people that are so corrupt, they're so deadly, they're so poisonous, they're so enraged, they're so counterproductive that their death, while not bringing God pleasure, their death is certainly not going to cause him any grief.
Well, God's been through this before, and let's not forget the Rainbow Covenant. You know,
God
was dismayed as the loss in the flood, and to the point that he resolved not to destroy the world, you know, by water again, and you have the Rainbow Covenant.
Yep, you are correct.
So, we can expect a similar reaction on his behalf this time around by fire, but he knows, you know, there's nothing we can tell him about this, you know.
Yeah, it's true. But so, I don't think there's any, if I was coming across as a pity party here, I apologize, because that was certainly not my intent.
I do think it's... I understand lament.
I think it's appropriate to lament. You don't risk your life, and I've had 10,000 death threats, you know, you don't risk your life and devote your time to doing something like this and not care about the results. I mean, you do it because you care. And so when you realize that that most people don't care enough about their own lives and their families' lives to avail themselves of the information which can save both, you know, occasionally there is a lament and say, boy, that was...
Absolutely. You know, and then again, there's always the possibility, of hidden fruit, of unaccounted for fruit that you were of which you were unaware. You know, the seed planted, the blossoms later, the unobserved change of mind, you know, that sort of thing. So,
I've received many, many letters from Muslims, countless letters from former Muslims around the world who primarily listen to the audio version of Prophet of Doom. It is per capita. Prophet of Doom is read and listened to vastly more per capita in countries like Iran and Iraq and the mythical territories ascribed to the Palestinians and Islamic countries around the world. The per capita readership of Prophet of Doom is much greater than it is in the West. And so I do get letters quite often from former Muslims and said, thank you. This was the final tool that helped me understand the what I knew to be problems with this religion. So you're right. There are benefits and for the a single individual saved from that horrid religion, or a single individual who was part of Christianity who has come to know Yahweh, then it is certainly worth our time.
Well, I'm not necessarily on the same page with that one, but you're aware of that. I mean, I think you understand by now that my approach, you know, to your teaching, you know, which I would call doctrine, you just love use the word doctrine, is that, you know, I'm taking a sort of an eclectic, you know, bird's eye view, sociological, you know, view of things, and doctrine, you know, I'm interested in elucidating and ascertaining and elucidating the doctrine, not necessarily engaging to debate it.
Yeah, and my view would be that I don't have any doctrine and I don't have any teaching. That the only purpose of the second after the only purpose, and yeah, you can laugh if you want, but the entire purpose of the second half of this program is singular. Yahweh does have teaching. Yahweh does, he does not have doctrine, but he does have teaching. He has instruction and he has guidance. It is essential for those who wish to know him to know what he actually said. And the only thing that I think I add to the equation that isn't common is that in addition to trying to convey what he said, I like to make connections. That's how we transition from knowing to understanding. And so the connections between the various things that he has said and what they mean, you know, for example, he uses Passover as the doorway to life in Mitzrayim to begin the Exodus. And so when you evaluate what is the purpose of Passover, and if you make the connection to the first time that it is discussed, and you connect everything else that God says to it, you come to understand its purpose. And so My only contribution beyond just sharing his teaching is to share connections that might help others make the transition from knowing to understanding.
Well, I understand, you know, that you're earnest, you know, in your convictions and where you're coming from. My only concern is that I think there are certain ways in which you're shooting yourself in the foot, such that 15 years hence you could end up being known as the next Herbert Armstrong or Harold Camping.
The gallows laugh there is not commendable there, Glenn. The realization here is that if I were quoting from the Christian New Testament and was using Paul to convey a message and trying to denounce the Torah based upon Paul's justifications for doing so, then I could certainly be cast in with those who have been misled and misguided in the past.
But there are
enormous differences which are extraordinarily important. I have no followers and want no followers. I have no institution and will establish no institution. I don't claim any credibility on my own. I don't claim any unique ability on my own. I don't even collect money from anyone to do this. It's strictly communicate what Yah said. Welcome back to Shattering Mist. I'm your host, Yetta. We've had some comments from Glenn that are thoughtful. I would, of course, disagree with them. I've been sharing my insights. Actually, I agreed with what Glenn said initially. I think his insights relative to the covenant and God's frustration with us are quite accurate. It's interesting, and I was talking with Scott during the commercial break, that my understanding and my conviction based upon my understanding of Yahweh has evolved in the sense of growing. When I first began this project and tried to, as accurately as possible, translate Yah's Torah teaching and the teaching from his prophets, I was just blown away by the insights that could be gleaned from his testimony, and how those insights stimulated this desire to connect what God was saying with other things that he had said, so as to understand. And you know, some of the initial thoughts, which was that, you know, you can show that not only did Yahusha systematically on the right day enable each of the promises of the associated with the first four Moed Mikrei, Pesach, Matzah B'Kodem, and Shavua, but that you could go right on through and associate the meaning of each particular day and the path to God that is that flows out of the covenant and ends up with his home. And then you realize, wow, that's not only profound, but why is anybody else talking about that? And what I found is then the more that I translated his testimony and the better I got at it, and I still would not say that, you know, I'm the world's best translator. And one of the reasons that I always share the Hebrew words which comprise each statement that Yah makes is because I want people to look them up for themselves and to engage in their own conversation directly with God. And that's why I provide the tools to do so in the book, IntroToGod.org. Is that, each time that I turn the page, each time that, I began to look at the next thing that God said, it reinforced what he had shared with us just a moment ago. And I got finally to the point, and I know Larry's on the line with us now, that Larry got to what I would consider to be the Einstein moment. Now, I'm not comparing my intellect to Einstein. I'm going to use Einstein as a comparison here. Einstein looked at the enormity of the universe and decided he would never be satisfied until the enormity of the universe could be explained simply. That the fabric of space-time was based upon the relativity of light. And that matter and energy were exactly the same stuff. And that, which is the basis of energy equals mass times the square of the speed of light. When he was able to deduce the enormity and the complexity and the sophistication of vast systems down to a simple nugget, he knew he'd arrived at truth. And then when everything that could be tested and verified affirmed that, then once again, he knew he had arrived at truth. And as I studied what Yahweh shared with us, and I don't have any special insights, I'm reading the same text that he made available to all of us. As I studied that, and I came to understand what he was offering, what I found is the utter simplicity of it can be deduced to really a single word, family. That if you want to broaden it slightly, it's the Torah provides guidance as to how to participate in God's family, and that God has provided a path by which his children can walk to him and live forever in his home. But it's really not any more complicated than that. Larry will join with you as we transition to the next hour, but truly, it is that simple. Yahweh created a covenant relationship so that we can engage in a relationship with him. He has invited us to become his children, to live with him in his family, and done everything necessary for that to happen. Well, we've had a longer period of time here with the music playing, but what a wonderful thought that you can deduce everything that our Heavenly Father said down to a simple word, one concept, family.